Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. We're coming to the end of March 2017, I wanted to start off with some disturbing news relevant to this show. I think many of my listeners have already read about the saga, the persecution of Michael Kharkov. He is a 98-year-old man, an American citizen living in Minnesota. He has Alzheimer's. Being 98, he doesn't have long to go, you would think. My understanding is that he's pretty spry, but he's been accused of Nazi war crimes. And so the Polish government, this is where it allegedly happened, has written up an indictment to bring him and try him in front of a Polish court. There is a specific body controlled by the Polish government about the persecution of the Polish nation, the commission to prosecute crimes against the Polish nation. And this is what is, this is a group of people who are bringing this indictment. I'm not saying that the Jewish elite are not a part of this. This is not the first time that Kharkov has been accused of something. This is the only time where they've claimed that it stuck. Let me read the indictment here from the Polish government. It says, quote, on 23rd July 1944, Kharkov's company was responsible for the pacification of villages in the Lublin region, including Chilnow, in retaliation for the killing of Polish partisans of a German liaison officer, as well as 44 unarmed civilians, including children and babies, were murdered in that town and the neighboring village of Wacławin, end quote. They're claiming that he was a part of the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion, which was a part of the 14th Waffen or Combat Grenadier Division of the SS. It is true that this legion was an autonomous part of that particular unit of the SS. They came only from Galicia because Himmler believed that the Galicians were Westerners and hence were better able to be trusted than anyone else. That these were the less Russified, or the less Marxified, of all of them. But there's a few things here that's disturbing. Apart from the fact that he's 98 and has Alzheimer's and can't possibly testify in his own defense, the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion came into existence because the Polish government, once it was reconstituted after World War I, engaged in its own pacification movements in Western Ukraine, Volhynia and Galicia. And it destroyed the rebirth of Ukrainian institutions, the schools and churches, and forcibly Polonized the area. Now, this area had been a battleground between Poland and Ukraine for a long time. Galicia had only been a part of the Russian Empire for a brief period of time. So it is definitely a Western area, but being under Polish control was not a pleasant experience. It was an exploitative imperial government. Now, I want to say, I said this before, but the Polish Empire, which was finally done away with at the end of the 18th century, was not Polish in the sense that there was some Polish representative government that controlled other countries. Rather, it was a series of noble families organized into confederations that didn't see themselves as Polish. They saw themselves as Sarmatians, partially a Slavic tribe, and in the form of a warrior tribe that they allegedly descended from, and hence it justified their position as the elite, and it justified their serfdom of both Poles and Ukrainians because they weren't of the same race. So calling it a Polish government is a bit eccentric. So this has nothing to do with Poland as such, but has to do with this elite class, the Slacha, who claim to be descended from the Sarmatian tribe, the warrior tribe, similar to the Scythians, that roamed the steppe at one point, and then settled in what we now call Poland, and became, therefore, because they were nomadic warriors, the warrior elite of the area. None of this is true, by the way. It's just this is how the Slacha justify themselves. It's much easier to oppress your fellow nationals if you don't think you're a fellow national. So they were historically different from other Poles, ethnically different from other Poles, though they were generally Roman Catholics. Kharkov is a unit, which is a creation to some extent of both the Vatican and the Polish government at the end of the 16th century, 1595 to be exact. Now, the real problem is the headlines. I've read headlines from the Washington Post about this guy from CNN, and they're claiming that this is absolutely the man who slaughtered babies in Chladno and Vladislavin. Now, the minute you hear the word babies, you know it's a lie. Because no one, no soldier, no man, sane or insane, is going to gratuitously kill babies in wartime. The minute they mention that, you know it isn't true, and you know it's propaganda. No one would deliberately kill children. The odd part is that the indictment says 44 unarmed civilians were killed. Well, the problem there is that Polish partisans, whether they're red and Jewish partisans overwhelmingly, working for the Soviet Union, were civilians by definition. Keep in mind, the rules of war only apply to uniformed soldiers. They don't apply to partisans or guerrillas. In a guerrilla war, your enemy doesn't wear a uniform, doesn't have a structure, doesn't have a ranking system, sometimes doesn't even have a government that sponsors it. A partisan is outside of the laws of war because they force their opponent to not be able to make the distinction between a combatant and a non-combatant. They can't not fight them. Therefore, everyone becomes a civilian. Therefore, the rules of war don't apply. Killing a civilian in that particular case would be okay because in a guerrilla war, they're all civilians. A combatant is a member of an army, a regular fighting force. Now, at least they admit that the German liaison officer was murdered. But, of course, the Polish partisans, these were Jewish leftists as well as Poles, and certainly were some Polish nationalists involved as well, had been attacking German units for a long time. They were rewarded by with their labor with the enforceable incorporation into the Warsaw Pact into the Soviet Union. So the partisans can't possibly even be popular today. But in fighting the Germans, they ensured the victory of the Soviet Union. Therefore, joining something like the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion made sense at the time. Now, the fact is that the Nazi hunters are running out of people to prosecute. They need to keep this constantly in the public mind. And as a result, cover over the crimes of the Soviet Union that they so loyally served, and Western capitalism so loyally served. Prosecuting this man also has another purpose. Today, the partisans are the Antifa group, elite funded, financed by the Rockefeller Foundation, George Soros. They use foundation giving to foundation to launder the money, but they are well financed. that are paid at least in kind, if not in money. And at least some of them are aware that they're fighting for the capitalist powers. That any attack on them, no matter how violent they are, will be met with the same response as any attack on the enemies of Stalin. In other words, to do battle with the communists, whether in the streets of America or in 1944, will be met with the same kind of force. That no one is safe, even if you're 98 years old. Now, there's not a shred of evidence that this man was even there. They're trying to claim that an old, very grainy photo of him can be measured against a photo of him today, and therefore there could be a parallel and a match found, and therefore they're absolutely certain that it's him. Unfortunately, most of the experts in this field completely reject that. The Lublin police units that have been doing this for some time have completely rejected. Actually, it's called the Lublin Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation, and the Forensic Laboratory of the police headquarters of Lublin as well, have both said that this is not evidence. The it's simply too old. The pictures of him are too old, and you can't use facial recognition with that against something today. That is simply not evidence. That Slavs from Galicia have a certain look to them, and many of them could fit within can be matched up against one old picture from 1944 or before that. Otherwise, now there's no reason to believe that he was actually there, although he may have been. Even if he was, he still hasn't done anything wrong. He didn't kill civilians. I read Michael Milnick's 2007 work, To Battle, the Formation and History of the 14th Waffen SS Grenadier Division. And of course, it deals with the Ukrainian unit. The Ukrainian unit there was an autonomous part of it. And in becoming a part of the SS, they made certain demands on Himmler. And one of them was that we're not going to fight the Western Allies, including the Poles. We're only going to fight the USSR. In other words, their purpose was to create the military groundwork for Ukrainian independence, at least Western Ukrainian independence, once the war was over. They realized that a victory for Stalin would be a total disaster, worse than a victory for Hitler. But by the time this occurred in 1944, and the Ukrainians were only brought into the SS near the end of the war, it was pretty clear that Germany wasn't going to win. The best they could hope for was some kind of negotiated peace between the two powers, such that Western Ukraine could have some wiggle room between the two. That was not to be. We know that the Germans had offered to surrender with conditions many times in 1944 and 45. But because enough Germans hadn't been slaughtered, it was turned down. And people forget about that. It's extremely important to remember that both Germany and Japan had offered to surrender. Therefore, the attacks on German cities and civilians, which was a daily event that was occurring at the same time that this alleged event occurred, it occurred unnecessarily. It occurred because, this was a terror operation against them. The Japanese cities were based, had houses made of wood and paper. And to firebomb them was to deliberately slaughter civilians. It's long since been established that that was a policy of both the U.S. and the RAF. The Army Air Corps are known for this kind of hatred of humanity. And they have blood on their hands. And so the bizarre thing is that even if he was guilty of this kind of thing, this was occurring at exactly the same time as the RAF and the U.S. Army Air Corps were incinerating entire cities in Japan and Germany for the purpose of terrorizing the government. Now, the stated purpose at the time was to terrorize the government, to force them to surrender, but to do so unconditionally. But so long as there was any kind of a hope that a negotiated peace could occur before Berlin was taken or Japan was invaded, they fought on. And of course, the Western powers knew this. Now, they've reproduced a Polish website dedicated to this man. They've reproduced his application for admission into the labor camps of controlled by the Allied powers, and then going into England and then into the U.S. And he says he was never a part of any military movement or operation. Now, that may be true, it may not be true. If it's not true, and he was a part of this military group, it's certainly acceptable. You can't go to the Allied armies in the end of 1945 and say, yes, I fought for the 14th SS. So he had every reason to lie. In and of itself, that's certainly not an immoral thing, especially if he thought that he'd be sent to Stalin, as so many of them were. Remember, the anti-communist movement was destroyed by the United States in Eastern Europe by through Operation Keelhaul, which many of you know very well, which was under the direct command of General Eisenhower to bring anti-communist forces, you know, Cossacks and Chetniks and all that, back to the USSR, where they knew they would be destroyed. It's not the first time that the United States destroyed the anti-communist movement. In Vietnam, for example, the U.S. destroyed everybody who couldn't be controlled by the CIA. There were many anti-communist South Vietnamese that were liquidated, either by the U.S. directly or through the South Vietnamese government. As I've said many, many times, and as I will always say, the U.S. was never anti-communist. The U.S. never had any problem with Marxism, and for the most part, didn't know what it was. You know, couldn't explain its basic ideological components very well, and certainly didn't know what Bolshevism was ever. And the proof of it is their full support of Stalin's government during and after World War II, where some of the most militant anti-communist Orthodox people were sent to their certain death in Operation Keelhaul and other forcible repatriation. So even if this man is guilty of this crime, to prosecute him is absurd because the West was far worse in that respect. They did kill babies, not directly, of course, but young kids and babies in the firebombings of German and Japanese cities, especially near the end of the war. The claim is that this man was a second lieutenant who had the nickname of Volk or Wolf. Now, they've tried to match handwriting samples of the man who had this nickname and Mr. Karkok, and it didn't match. But they were dedicated to destroying this guy, to keep the attack on nationalism always in the public eye. So they went to this fake photo recognition thing. And of course, this special Polish unit for crimes against the Polish nation insists that it is accurate. The man who runs it is an attorney, Robert Janicki, and he is the head of the formal name is the Main Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation. And he says it's absolutely certain that Volk is Karkok. Now, as I've said, I've read Michael Melnick's 2007 work on the history of this unit. This is not a secret book. And it explains in detail what this unit was doing. Now, the newspaper headlines say he was an SS commander, which isn't true because this was an autonomous part of the Waffen-SS in its own separate organization, although it did have a German commander. It wasn't a part of the SS ideology and didn't accept that particular aspect of National Socialism, and certainly didn't accept the rule of Eric Koch in Ukraine. They were petrified, though, of Stalin the ridiculous claim of being a Nazi collaborator suggests that they should have accepted and even fought for Stalin rather than Hitler. That to save the Jews of Europe, it was worth it for you to accept Stalinist dictatorship over your country. And so that claim in general is laughable. Any of us would have done the same at the time. They knew it was a desperate gamble, that Germany was losing, but they were hoping to inflict enough losses on the Soviet Union such that they could not occupy Ukraine. Regardless of what you think about Adolf Hitler, the fact is that he broke the back of Soviet military power. Whatever his plans were in Asia or in Europe, and he certainly believed in international revolution, he certainly believed in spreading the revolution and invading Central Europe at least, and setting up Soviet governments with the assistance of local Jewish elites, as you saw in Bavaria and elsewhere, and Hungary especially, two places that did have a people's republic, so to speak, prior to the end of World War II. Now, so the claim is laughable. This unit, though, is worth talking about, which is very interesting. This was, we're talking about July of 1944. They're saying on the 22nd of July, 23rd, is when this occurred, this alleged crime occurred. But Melnick's book makes it clear that this unit was destroyed by the evening of the 21st. It was resuscitated much later, but was used in Slovenia against partisans and very quickly destroyed again, its members having scattered and fled to Canada and the U.S. The Canadian government, as I've said before, has already cleared this unit of any wrongdoing. And there's a claim in 1986, Simon Wiesenthal had tried to get the members of the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion tried in Israel for war crimes and, of course, killed, finishing Stalin's work. And this is actually surprising, but the Canadian government actually snapped at Wiesenthal, and they said the following, quote, "It is obvious that the list of 217 officers of the Galicia division furnished by Mr. Wiesenthal was nearly totally useless and put the Canadian government, through RCMP and this commission, to a considerable amount of purposeless work. That additional information be long in coming may not be surprising under those circumstances, and as a result, evidence of participation in war crimes has remained elusive." End quote. So the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion, of which Kharkov was allegedly a member, has been cleared officially by the Canadian government. And yet the newspaper headlines, Robert Zernicki, say that it's absolutely certain that he is a Nazi war criminal. The use of the word Nazi is bizarre. It's just a slang term. Kharkov was not German, was not interested in German interest. Was not interested in German imperialism, and there's no one who would deny that Melnick concluded that the people who were fighting for the Self-Defense Legion wanted an independent Western Ukraine, or at a very minimum, wanted to take revenge on Poland for its long-standing occupation and pacification program in that part of the world. But the unit itself was not fighting Polish partisans. According to Melnick's book, at the time, this man was supposed to be killing babies. What they really were doing was fighting off a massive Soviet attack from the 2nd Soviet Air Army, and had nothing to do with pacifying any local riots. The pacification of these villages was a part of the destruction of putting down the Warsaw Uprising. These were not police units. The day before he was supposed to have done this, the 21st of July, near the town of Olesko, he was up against a very large number of Soviet tanks commanded by Marshal Ivan Konev. and most of the self-defense unit's members were destroyed in the fighting. Later that day, a German panzer counterattack had rescued about 400 Galicians from the town of Brody, where they had been dug in. The Soviets had such overwhelming numbers, and German supplies were in such so weak that by the 22nd, the unit was gone. Yet, the Polish government wants to indict him for actions against civilians on the 23rd of July. The evidence doesn't add up. That division of the SS was finally destroyed by the Soviet 91st Independent Tank Brigade, Praskulov, on the 20, you know, by the end of the 21st, end of the 22nd. And the losses that they, both German and Ukrainian, were over 30,000. So there's no evidence whatsoever that the Self-Defense Legion was ever used as a police unit, that they were ever near those villages, that they ever had the responsibility of putting down any riots. But even if they were putting down attacks by partisans, not regular soldiers, and therefore war crimes become very hard to prove. Guerrillas are civilians, but they're still combatants. So partisans, especially those who commit terrorist acts, as they have done, don't have the protections of war crime statutes like regular soldiers would. So if he lied, you know, as a way to get into the West, that's understandable and has no moral significance. So nothing here adds up. Chances are he wasn't even a member of this group. Even if he was certainly not a Nazi commander by any means. He was a second lieutenant and was fighting Stalin, and so was the hero. But and certainly were not used as police forces. But even if they were, what they were doing was fighting a terrorist partisan force. That was a terrorist force, regardless of what you think about World War II. That's what partisans were. Guerrillas are terrorists by definition, because they don't follow the rules of war. They never have. They're not a regular force, and so they can't be treated that way. Plus the fact Stalin had repudiated the rules of war publicly right after the beginning of Operation Barbarossa. So at numerous levels, this indictment is false. It is impressive to read Melnick's book, because the German panzers, even without regular supplies, even with low morale, even with almost certain defeat looming, were able of inflicting substantial losses on the Soviet Union. And Soviet forces were victorious only through numbers only. So nothing here makes any sense. But the it's irritating to have the use of babies here. No one will deliberately kill babies. Once in a while you hear of a murder of a child, but they are such a tiny minority of human beings that it can't simply be assumed. No one is claiming that these people were criminally insane. They were soldiers in a desperate battle. No one denies that part of it. Those people will not kill babies or children or unarmed people, unless those unarmed people were a part of a partisan force. And it doesn't matter anyway, because as we know, the West was in the process of incinerating entire cities on both sides of the world at the time, in both theaters. The big question is why? Why are they obsessed with no evidence? They're aware that there's no evidence. They're aware that this man and his group has been cleared before. Why him? He has Alzheimer's disease. This does not make them look good. He's 98 years old. He can't testify. There can't be a fair trial. The evidence is very, very weak. Why are they doing this? Well, the only thing I can come up with here is that while it's true the West has supported in a very limited way Ukrainian nationalist groups, at least in 2014 during the riots, the regime only has nationalism as an enemy. Of course, it hates nationalism, Ukrainian or otherwise. The New World Order has the purpose of the destruction of local cultures, especially ethnic and religious ones, to create a single world order of isolated individuals, easily controlled and herded, with a single government, a single currency, a single set of regulations to reduce transaction prices, transaction costs to the absolute minimum, thereby increasing profits on the one hand and suppressing wages on the other. In the simplest way, that's what the New World Order is. Its primary enemy, of course, then has to be nationalism, since nationalism is based on precisely the opposite. Any attempt to support a nationalist group, the occasional support of black nationalists in America, the support of certain African nationalists in the 1960s, the support of Ukrainian nationalists in 2014, Croatian nationalists in the 1990s, etc. This has nothing to do with the support of nationalism. These are merely strategic investments in a specific area. And the minute they no longer have any use, they're thrown under the bus. The only time the U.S. will use force against a group of people is if nationalism is rising and will somehow inconvenience American economic interests. That's the case everywhere. Nationalism and nationalism alone is the sole and exclusive enemy of the New World Order and hence the United States. It doesn't matter that the U.S. had been supporting these, and keep in mind, these Ukrainian nationalist groups were not the real thing. The right sector and these other groups, these were fighting, and they were known at the time to be fighting for the cosmopolitan New World Order, which, of course, people like Stepan Bandera, who is not a bad man whatsoever. I've read all of his material in the original. He was a national socialist in every way. He was anti-Russian, but he did not trust the West and did not trust capitalism. So in no way could his brand of nationalism be motivating these groups who were fighting in 2014. So these weren't legitimate nationalists. Some of them may have been strategically using that position just to get rid of Yanukovych. Well, I find that very doubtful. Most of the people arrested during those riots were foreigners or those that were not known to be a part of these groups. They were organizations of gangs and thugs rather than any kind of ideological movement. The Ukrainian nationalists were not Nazis in any sense. And it's one area where I vehemently disagree with my friends and allies in the Eastern Ukrainian republics. None of them supported Hitler because of the errors of Erich Koch and the fact that Koch and the SS had banned Ukrainian nationalist meetings and gatherings from 1944 onward. And it was very, very difficult for them to even accept the Galician division into the SS. So little did they trust the Slavs of any kind. And it was also common at the time to confuse Ukrainians and Poles. Stepan Bandera accepted everything that any other nationalist in the world would accept, except he sought the resurrection of Ukraine, which was a legitimate aspiration. Ukraine is a different nation, it's a different culture, at least in the central and western parts of it, and therefore should have some form of independence. I've been saying this and arguing this for a long time. The problem is that the destruction wrought by the 2014 gang controlled by the U.S. Has completely delegitimized Ukrainian nationalism, even though there was no real nationalist movement occurring there, and they were not involved, at least not in any ideological sense. It's been discredited because they've appeared to have been fighting for the cosmopolitan New World Order, which is what created the current Kiev government. Kiev does not have an independent government whatsoever. It is entirely and completely controlled by the U.S. and the IMF, which means it's controlled by the world's bankers. It does has no, and this is fully admitted in the Ukrainian press, that the Kiev has no freedom of action whatsoever. It has no money of its own, has no functional economy, certainly has no functional military, and therefore is nothing more than a puppet of the Western powers. And Poroshenko is a very pathetic leader and is certainly no Ukrainian nationalist. These people are not national socialists. And part of this SS, this self-defense force becoming a part of the SS proves it. Because they wouldn't be a part of this 14th Division unless certain political concessions were granted. And the Germans were so desperate at the time that they accepted them. It's true that Ukraine has generally been more pro-Western than Russians. They were pro-German in World War I and for most of World War II. It doesn't mean they're National Socialists or Hitlerians. And it certainly doesn't mean they accepted the policies of Kohl. As I said before, Hitler's greatest mistake during the war was to send Kohl in and to send the SS in and to oppress the Ukrainian national parties the way he did. Whether willingly or not, it lost him the war. Because he knew he could have had a huge country, fanatically anti-Stalinist, to back him up, and of course most Russians as well. But because there was this prejudice against Slavs, Koch's movement, the head of the SS in Ukraine and the head of the civilian government there, destroyed any support that Ukrainians had for the German invasion. We all know, and I've had a podcast on Koch before. He was not punished at Nuremberg. He did commit crimes. He actually did commit war crimes as the head of the SS in Ukraine, and yet escaped judgment at Nuremberg. He was arrested. He was in custody. He lived a long life. That's pretty much smoking gun proof that he was working for Stalin, but he was working for the West in some way or another. So to think that the Bandera movement, the OUN, was Nazi is laughable. The word Nazi shows people's ignorance. It implies that they're Germans and that they live in 1920s Austria. National Socialism is far bigger than the Nazi movement is concerned, but it's just an insult term. And it's used by people who are stupid and simply don't know. The stupidity here is that they don't understand the technicality, the complexity of the era. They think, well, this was a part of an SS unit, therefore they were Nazis. And simply not the case. Intelligence is the ability to make greater and greater and finer distinctions in concepts. And the fact is that this movement had approached Himmler for incorporation to the German army only because it was the only game in town. Now, I said before on the show that the Orthodox Church in both Ukraine and outside of Russia were extremely pro-Hitler. And it wasn't just that he was the only way that Stalin was going to be defeated, but because that National Socialism, at best, is the Orthodox social point of view. It does derive and have many connections with the prophetic ideology in the Old Testament. They were both nationalists and socialists in a very, very broad sense of the term. I know it's anachronistic to use terms like that, but they most certainly were in a general sense. The prophets were extremely egalitarian in their point of view of economics, but incredibly insular in their view of the national order. So they were national socialists in general. The pro-German Russian groups, as I've mentioned on this show before, in Lokot and elsewhere, in the Vlasov movement, created experimental national socialist communities. You know, National Socialism is as broad as socialism is, as Marxism is. You could be a communist without being a Stalinist. Therefore, you could be a National Socialist without being a Hitlerian. I'm a National Socialist, but I'm not a Hitlerian. I'm not a Hitlerian because of what occurred in Ukraine. And I don't believe, though, that Adolf Hitler personally was fully aware of what was happening there. I think he was very dependent on intelligence reports coming from Kiev, and therefore was dependent on what Himmler and Koch were telling him, and Rosenberg as well. I don't believe that Hitler was inherently anti-Slavic in the sense that they didn't have a strong Nordic aspect of their population. They're not stupid. They did know that. They feared them, though, because if they were Sovietized, they suddenly became a Mongol horde. Sovietization meant that they believed that human beings were just bundles of nerve endings without a soul or without real freedom. They became a horde, therefore. So the Self-Defense Legion that Kerkhoff might have been a part of was a National Socialist movement, but so were most of the movements in 1960s Africa. So were all the anti-colonial movements throughout the world. They were both socialist in the sense that they were generally egalitarian in their economic point of view and statist. They were also nationalist because they sought the independence of their nation against the colonial power. I said this in the past, but if you reject nationalism, then you deny that imperialism exists. Because imperialism is defined as one nation crushing and exploiting another one. The only justification for being against imperialism is the nation. That a nation is being is under attack from an imperial power. So if you deny that nations exist, which is the official American academic and journalistic and governmental point of view, then there can be no such thing as imperialism, which is convenient. Because the U.S. is the imperial power. Now remember, the New World Order is just is far broader than the United States. It doesn't believe in nations at all, except the Jewish one. Jews are this is the Tikkun Olam. The New World Order is materialist and is Judaic to its core, although not exclusively so. National Socialism is marked by the fact that it realizes foreign, especially Jewish, participation in the economic order means that their internal cohesion and international connections give them an unfair advantage against nationals. Liberalism was the dissolving of voluntary and involuntary social associations, meaning that the most cohesive group will win automatically, and that was the Jewish elite. So whether knowingly or not, liberalism was this empowering of the Jews. Regardless of that, Johnson's law here is applicable because the way that newspapers have been reporting this shows such a tremendous ignorance of World War II, the military situation, and the ethnic situation that it can't even be read. It's unreadable. But if people don't know anything, they believe that they're getting the truth here. And so few people are able to refute it that there's no real incentive to dig into these details. Although the history of the 14th Waffen-SS Division is fairly easy to find and very easy to understand. The dates are very, very clear. But there's no question that Kerkhoff has not done anything wrong, that he may even have been a member of the Self-Defense Legion. Plus the fact that the methods that they're using to bring him to Poland have been refuted, and he's been cleared in the past. And there's so many reasons to reject this, and yet they're demanding it. And that's so the truth of the matter is not what's at issue here. Truth doesn't matter. I don't doubt that Poles and Jews involved in this are aware of where the Self-Defense Legion was on the 21st, 22nd, 23rd of July, 1944. The books there are not secret ones. They could find them. But at a time where Antifa is attempting to take the streets in American major cities, thereby banning nationalism. They need to show their support for anyone who would crush the nationalist movement. The Ukrainian nationalist movement was legitimate, especially as it was appointed against Poland, because they were one of the worst and most exploitative imperial powers in existence. The big difference between Russian and other forms of imperialism was that Russian imperialism was based on self-defense. They didn't profit from imperialism. They didn't profit from absorbing other ethnic groups into the empire. And most of these ethnic groups were independent within the empire. Empires are not states. They're very different from each other. But the British model, or the Polish model, Amsterdam model, the Jewish model of imperialism is based entirely on economic self-interest. And it's very rare to find a historian that will deny that Polish serfdom was some of the worst that's ever been recorded. It was slavery in all senses of the term. So the Self-Defense Legion came into existence for every legitimate reason imaginable, that they were not going to go under Stalin. They were not going to be a part of a large and growing Poland. And they feared that if the Allies won, that Poland would grow even further and reabsorb that part of the world into itself. And the but Ukrainian attacks on Poles were always in retaliation for centuries of exploitation. And it doesn't make any difference that this man is Ukrainian. Nationalism of any kind has to be dealt with this way. They're well aware that the Self-Defense Legion was not an SS unit. They were a part of an SS unit. But their very conditions for being absorbed into it were very strict and accepted at the time, especially given the panic that was happening in the summer of 1944. And yet you read these headlines that say, top Nazi commander living in Minnesota. Now, I could say that the journalists and reporters are simply too ignorant about the topic to make any sense out of this. They are literate, as far as I know, so they could actually read about it. But they're not going to go against the Simon Wiesenthal Center or anybody who's hunting Nazis. And again, the term is so ignorant that anyone using it is automatically reveals themselves. But it's important to note that the Ukrainian nationalist movement does have legitimate background. Central and Western Ukraine are very different from Russia. They're Orthodox, but they're Western-looking. There's nothing wrong with this. The Ukrainian model that I advocate is one that Gogol advocated. Even Anthony Kropivitsky, as very few realize, believed in a very strong level of Ukrainian autonomy, if not independence, at least in the West, as an Orthodox country in union with Russia. So the model we're looking at is the same as Minsk, an independent country in union with Russia and looking eastward for their economic development. It's hard to argue for the eastern part of Ukraine to be independent under a single Ukrainian government in Kiev or Lvov. And it's been depopulated many times by the Soviet government. And keep in mind also that the Cossack movement up until the revolution in Ukraine was not pro-Russian. Even those pro-Russian elements of the Cossack host, like Novorossiya so many of the left bank hetmans at the time were very strict in their negotiations with the Russian Empire. They did not trust the Russian Empire, they did not trust the Polish Empire, and they wanted to play them off against one another. The Cossacks were old believers, Orthodox, they were royalists in many ways. But they did not believe that Ukraine should be a part of Russia. They should work with Russia for Orthodox interests, that's for certain. But as an independent Cossack nation. So until the very end, until the Sikh was destroyed, I mean, the Sikh itself was extremely anti-imperial and was not going to be a part of the Russian Empire. So using the Cossacks is weak. The more pro-Russian factions, even there, had conditions that they would send to St. Petersburg for their cooperation. And usually it would be accepted but then rejected immediately in practice. So the Cossacks were believed in Ukrainian independence as an Orthodox country, as an Eastern-looking Orthodox country. Central and Western Ukraine are very different from linguistically and legally. They were not a part of the Russian Empire. They were only for a very short time. They were under the Poles. They were under Lithuanians. They were under the Turks. They were foreigners. And remember that they were treated as foreigners by Petrograd. Peter the Great had translators dealing with Mazepa. Mazepa saw that Peter the Great had no respect for human life, had exploited Ukraine to the point where it was now poverty-stricken, and therefore looked for other options. He was absolutely correct to go to Karl in Sweden. And I would have done the same. Peter the Great was exploiting Ukraine beyond belief, and he had no respect for human life. And the very fact that Petrograd itself was built on the bodies of tens of thousands of Cossacks that he worked to death there shows that even pro-Russian Cossacks did not want to be a part of the Russian Empire. They believed in the Orthodox Empire, though. They believed in monarchy. They did not believe in the Nikonian Rite. They did not believe in the Petrograd system. They believed they were an autonomous part of the Moscow Empire, but independent. Cossacks certainly will not be a part of any empire anyway. Even the most pro-Russian Cossack hetmans went to Russia with great distrust and had a laundry list of conditions which were always violated. You didn't have any hetman who just wanted to be a part of the Russian Empire and hence the throne himself. That didn't exist. So on those grounds, Ukraine is a separate Cossack state in the central and western regions. It's true that the eastern Ukraine was the birth of many Ukrainian nationalist movements, that the autocephalous church is actually quite large in eastern Ukraine. That distinction should not be overdrawn. There are plenty of Ukrainian nationalists in eastern Ukraine, but it had been depopulated many times and replaced by Russians, especially during industrialization. That's not the fault of those living there, and they shouldn't be forced to be a part of it. And that's why the Nova Russia movement is so legitimate and correct. And that is, it's not Russia, it's not Ukraine. So, on those grounds, I accept Ukrainian. This was also Gogol's point of view, that Ukrainian is different from Russian. Ukrainian customs are different. Ukrainian orthodoxy is different. Ukrainian iconography and architecture is different. Now, of course, Gogol was very pro-Russian. He believes in the Orthodox Empire, but he didn't believe that Ukraine should be absorbed into it. They're two different things. The Russian Empire was very humane in terms of its imperial commitments. Imperialism, and that we shouldn't even use the term, because this wasn't about exploiting a country for economic gain. That was not the case at all. Russia lost money on its imperial powers, but it needed to control enemies, would be the West through whether Finland or Poland, for example, or the Turks in the Caucasus. They were almost completely independent. You know that the Polish revolution against the Russian Empire was completely phony and financed by the West, because there'd be no reason to overthrow the Russian presence there, because the Russian presence there didn't exist. The only thing that Poland couldn't do is have its own foreign policy, which means it couldn't turn its currency to Western interests. And this is why the so-called Polish nationalist movement came into existence. Poland was an independent part of the Russian Empire. And an error that the Tsars made was keeping Wesołacza in power, far less obnoxious than before, but they were still in power. throughout its existence. And of course, this very privileged group, already, you know, the ruling class of Poland at the time, was recruited by England, and they were deeply Masonic as well, especially in the late 18th century, and sought to sought independence against the Russian Empire. But they were already independent. Finland was completely independent, almost in terms of foreign policy. Not quite, of course. This was not imperialism. It existed, though, because these countries, either alone or in combination with others, were enemies of Russia. And Russia, being as exposed as it is geographically, needed these buffer states. That's an imperative. There's nothing wrong with that. So the Cossack movement and the Ukrainian national movement is aware of this. You can be pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian at the same time. The situation in 2014 and 2004 has destroyed that idea. Ukrainian nationalists have a problem with Peter the Great. They have a problem with the Soviet Union, but so do I. They were imperialists. They had no right to rape Ukraine. And most of the Russian victories against Turkey were because of the Cossacks. They hired the Cossacks as their main guides and the center of the Russian army into this era, into this area. I have a whole radio show here on Ivan Serka, who was kept from destroying the Turkish Empire by the Russian Empire. I have a podcast on the Kolchicina Rebellion, or the Hajdemak Rebellion, where the Polish government there was supported by Catherine II. So if it was in their interest, they certainly would support other imperial powers. So even there, even the victories against Islam were not Russian as so much they were the Cossack. The Cossack movement was never never believed in absorption into the Russian Empire whatsoever. It doesn't mean that the core of it didn't believe in the Orthodox monarchy, however, in the much older Moscow sense. They were vehemently opposed to Russia in the sense of the guise of the Petrograd Gnostic system, where Peter the Great and his friends had exploited Ukraine and destroyed its economy and forced its economy to serve Petrograd and creating Russian monopolies in the country. And this is the advent of Mazepa's movement and the idea that Petrograd can't be trusted. So it's not anti-Russian at all. It's anti-Petersburg. It's anti-Peter the Great and certainly anti-Stalin. There's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with the Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion, which is at issue here. They were at war with Poland. It's easy to see why they would take action against Polish civilians, and even that they may be justified if these civilians are in fact partisans. But we know that there's absolutely no evidence to connect Michael Karkok to this movement or to these massacres, as if these massacres are something special at a time where the U.S. was incinerating German cities. The man is innocent, and it does show you how vicious our enemies are. It's a very sad story, and we wish him the best. We pray for Michael Karkok and for all those suffering under the weight of the New World Order. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.